Good afternoon. It is 19 minutes after 5 o'clock, and you're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW, Sitka. Today is Friday, September 6th, 2013. I'm Ed Ronco with Raven News. The domestic violence shelter in Sitka is stepping up its community training program following the release of new survey data last year. SAFE, or Sitkins Against Family Violence, has routinely offered volunteer advocate training, but now the organization is hoping to involve more of the community in how to recognize and address Sitka's incredibly high rate of intimate partner violence. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The numbers are staggering. According to the 2012 Alaska Victimization Survey, almost half of all women living in Sitka have experienced intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or both.
This is actually a surprise.
Martina Kurzer is the community coordinator for Sitkins Against Family Violence.
Not only for us, but particularly for those who are not really steeped in the issue.
282 adult women in Sitka were surveyed last year by researchers at the University of Alaska Anchorage's Justice Center. It was part of an ongoing statewide effort by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Kurzer says SAFE's training is being offered this year not just to shelter volunteers, but to the entire community, free of charge. While the victimization survey quantifies a significant amount of physical violence experienced by women and the threat of physical violence, Kurzer says the training is designed to break down our assumptions.
It's not battering, because that's a very, very limited definition, and we will define this term because there are other terms. If somebody always puts down somebody else, that's in a household, that's also a violent act, emotional or verbal, but we consider that violent.
Other common assumptions, Kurzer says, are that women will want to leave a relationship if they experience violence, or that there is no love in a violent relationship. She says the training helps participants see why both may be untrue.
Many of these assumptions just fall apart if you go through this, and then you have this, suddenly you start understanding what's going on next door. And also you learn what to do when you witness something that happens next door.
SAFE uses a combination of shelter staff and local professionals to teach the sessions, which take place over 3 Saturdays and 3 Monday evenings. Participants can drop in on any or all of the sessions. Kurzer says there is no one who would not benefit from the training. Anyone who has colleagues, coworkers, patients, or students will understand them better and become more compassionate.
I think we have reached now the step where we as a community can step up and say we can make a difference.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
SAFE's community training begins tomorrow. You can find a link to the session schedule along with a link to the Alaska Victimization Survey. All of that is available on our website, kcaw.org. The world's largest cruise corporation will soon install new pollution control equipment on 32 of its ships. Carnival, Princess, and Holland America vessels sailing Alaska waters are likely to be among those getting the gear. Here's Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld.
Carnival Corporation owns 10 cruise lines operating about 100 ships from ports in North America, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. It's a significant player in the Alaska market. Corporate officials say the technology, called scrubbing, will meet new international requirements for sulfur and smoke emissions. They say they'll spend about $180 million on the equipment over the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, we haven't determined which ships of the 32 will be implemented in what markets and what ports.
Roger Frizzell is a spokesman for Carnival, which is headquartered in Miami and London. He spoke from the Fort Lauderdale, Florida, airport.
Alaska is obviously an important market, and I'm expecting that if they don't have it right away, they will have it shortly.
The equipment has been tested on one ship's diesel engine so far. The evidence helped win conditional approval from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Coast Guard. Frizzell says Carnival eventually plans to use scrubbing on all of its 102 vessels.
This is going to be a real change in our industry, and I think it's something that for Alaska and other key ports is going to be beneficial to their environmental area.
Carnival scrubbers target sulfur oxides, which contribute to global warming and acid rain. They also remove soot and other small particles that make up ship's exhaust. Frizzell says the technology is common on shore.
This is the first time this combination is being developed to accommodate restricted spaces on the ships.
Did that require a significant re-engineering of the technology?
It did. When we moved it from the power plants and factories into the ship, it really was a complete overhaul of the existing systems and resizing.
I think there's just been a whole shift at Carnival with all the problems they've had and everything.
Industry critic Chip Toma of Juno says the corporation is making a significant and welcome change. But the president of the group responsible cruising in Alaska says it's not all good intentions.
They're making so much money. It's such a lucrative corporation. They've decided to switch gears and get into the 21st century, and it's a wonderful move that they've done so.
The EPA says the agreement is a trial effort, and the technology will be closely monitored. Carnival spokesman Frizzell says it exempts equipped ships from new, stronger air quality regulations aimed at lowering pollution along the coast.
The exemption gives us the flexibility to choose whatever fuel source we determine, and that's significant for us because it gives us an economic value.
That's because low-sulfur fuel is more expensive than what cruise ships usually burn. The agreement still requires Carnival ships to use that fuel while in port or plug into an onshore power source, as is done in Juneau. The EPA has also reached agreements with Royal Caribbean and Norwegian cruise lines, as well as barge companies and owners of some other large vessels. Some are using different approaches. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
More information is available on the agreement and the technology through links posted with this report on, you guessed it, our website, kcaw.org. The Bridge to Nowhere, remember that? Well, it's making a comeback, at least on paper. In what is considered a symbolic move, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly voted earlier this week to officially endorse two bridge options offered in the state's most recent Gravina Access Study. But they also added a statement that improved ferry service would be an acceptable alternative. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Assemblymember Mike Painter effectively sums up why Ketchikan's Borough Assembly has basically given up on a bridge to Gravina Island, but doesn't want to completely abandon the idea.
Hell will probably freeze over before we ever see a bridge. But we don't want to lose sight of that quest.
For those who are new to the issue, this is the long-planned, much-discussed, often-ridiculed so-called Bridge to Nowhere project. Ketchikan officials have asked for a bridge for many, many years, citing the need for better access to the airport, which was built by the state on neighboring Gravina Island. It's a short ferry ride, but many complain that it's inconvenient and that without a bridge, further development of Gravina Island will be challenging. Others argue that ferries can work great as long as they're dependable and available when needed. Right now, Ketchikan runs two daytime ferries in the summer and one during winter, and there's no late-night ferry service. In addition, a ferry ride costs at least $5, and if you want to take a vehicle over, it's quite a bit more. A request added to the borough's resolution was for the state to figure out how to make ferry rides more affordable as well as more convenient. One idea is an endowment established with some of the original federal funding intended for the project. Assemblymember Agnes Moran talked about the idea the next day and says it was suggested to Governor Sean Parnell.
And I guess the governor was interested enough in that to say, tell me more. So there's no commitment there, but that might be the way forward.
The comment period for the Gravina Access Study ended several weeks ago, and the Assembly already submitted its comments to the State Department of Transportation, essentially accepting better ferry service. For its resolution, though, the Assembly opted to keep bridges as its first choice with the added pro-ferry language. One member, though, disagreed enough to vote against the resolution. Todd Phillips has repeatedly argued that a bridge is the best option for developing Gravina, which is the one place in the borough with large chunks of open, relatively flat land. Here he is along with Assemblymember Glenn Thompson.
This is going to help our economy move it forward and bring in more things. We want our schools done well, open up some area where more families can be, and grocery stores and apartment buildings, more kids, more school, more funding. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me, but that's my opinion. Thank you.
Further discussion, Mr. Thompson.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I want to make sure that
Todd understands that we are, in fact, we're still supporting the bridges in this amendment.
We're kowtowing. I understand what it reads.
Okay.
But,
I just want to make sure you understand. I agree with you. The town's miles long, three blocks wide, and the only place to expand is on Gravina. But
thank you for pointing.
This also brings a little bit of reality to the whole situation on the cards we've been dealt.
At one point in its long history, it seemed as though Ketchikan's bridge would be built. Federal money was earmarked for the $400 million project, and serious planning was underway. But in 2007, former Governor Sarah Palin canceled it in response to a national backlash against earmarks. As the vice presidential candidate the following year, she called it the bridge to nowhere in many of her campaign speeches, and years later, it still is mentioned when pundits debate funding for special projects. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
A petition drive in Sitka and across the rest of the state of Alaska has paid off for people who want to repeal a controversial tax cut on oil companies. Division of Elections Director Gail Fanoumiai certified the referendum on the new tax law this week. While Alaska's lieutenant governor is usually the authority on ballot propositions, Mead Treadwell delegated that job to Fanoumiai. He says that he made that decision because of his status as a U.S. Senate candidate. In her letter to organizers of the repeal effort, Fanoumiai said the group Vote Yes, Repeal the Giveaway had met all of the legal requirements to get on the ballot. The division verified that more than 45,000 of the signatures they turned in came from registered voters. They needed 30,000 signatures to qualify. The group also met a requirement that those signatures come from across the state. Jim Whitaker is one of the sponsors of the referendum. He says he's not surprised that the Division of Elections okayed the measure and that he is happy.
I think all Alaskans should be pleased that we have a chance to make a decision individually about something that is going to affect the future of our state for a long time. And this is our shot. This is our chance to do what we think is right.
Supporters of the new policy argue that it will spur investment in the face of declining production. But those behind the repeal effort say the law will lower state revenue without any guarantee of more oil through the pipeline. If their referendum passes, Alaska would go back to a system where the tax rate goes up with the price of oil. The measure is slated to appear on the August 19th primary ballot in 2014.